What you're about to hear is the first chapter of Dietrich Bachstieber's autobiography, Not on the Mayflower. Dietrich Bachstieber was born in 1912 in Vienna, Austria, during the final years of the Habsburg monarchy, when the country flourished with abundant natural resources and high culture. In his memoirs, Bachstieber writes about his life in Austria during the first part of the 20th century and describes an Austria of great beauty and bounty that, over those years, diminished in size, culture, wealth, and prestige, due in large part to the breakup of the dual Habsburg Empire, the 1938 Anschluss, and the ensuing war. Bachstieber witnessed the most unsettling times in Austrian history, but in chapter one, he poignantly recounts the innocence of his own youth in 1931 when he was 18.
Blistering sunshine fell on the Karawanken, gilding the southern edges of their rocks in bright yellow crystals and scattering a shower of golden dust over the pine-covered foothills. From there, the glitter seemed to flow down to the surface of the lake, lazily alive with spots and freckles of golden glow. The water was clear, dark green in color, but that was only because the dark green pine forests were reflected in it, and because deep down, below the surface, there seemed to be another forest. It was not visible now, but at other times, when I had looked straight down, I could see dark green plants, waving slowly in the gentle currents of the lake. I was paddling rhythmically, and each time my right paddle dipped down into the dark green liquid crystal, it stirred up a miniature whirlpool, which lengthened and stretched as the paddle moved backward and some drops of liquid gold dropped into the end of my own self-made miniature maelstrom, which gobbled them up and made them green, liquid, crystal, and water again. Behind me, in perfect timing with the rhythm of my paddle strokes, another paddle dug into the water. It was a familiar rhythm. We had often paddled together, but never so smoothly, silently, and undisturbed. The water around us, the shores of the lake, and the mountains in the distance, all were enshrouded in perfect silence. Behind us lay the glittering resort town of Felden. Ahead, and to our right in the distance, was a peninsula jutting out from the foothills. A small church stood on it, surrounded by a cemetery, as usual in those small Austrian villages, and a few houses, small gardens, possibly a tiny inn. But it was that small peninsula, with the church called Maria Voigt, that had given the lake its name. Although on its shores there were several larger villages, towns, and even a real city at one end, far ahead in the distance, not yet visible. We had started out from Felden early that afternoon. It was another perfect summer day, as had been throughout the weeks before, crisp warm air, bright sunshine, and a deep blue sky, with only a few white clouds appearing very late every afternoon over the peaks of the mountains. They came from the south, from the Mediterranean, where the sun drew vapor from the sea and the north wind carried the moisture-laden air towards the mountains. There, the air rose into the colder layers where clouds were formed, but in this summer climate, they did not bring rain. They dispersed over the clear sky and disappeared again, leaving Felden, the lake, and all the hills, valleys, forests, and villages in the perfect sunshine of those August days. Felden was a tiny little town, whose major purpose in life seemed to be beautiful. Nature had done its part, providing the lake, the wooded hills, the mountains in the distance, and a mild, friendly climate, a reminder of the wider world to the south that stretched out beyond the mountain chain, that defined a limit beyond which, it seemed, one could not go. On the far side was another land of hills, lakes, and green pastures reaching out towards the shores of the Adriatic, where sandy beaches were drenched with sunshine. But it was forbidden to us, this land that had once been another part of Austria, like Felden, like the Lake of Voigt, like Vienna. A drop of that green golden water splashed on my right knee, bringing me out of my reverie. I turned around for a moment to glance back at Felden. Sadness would soon have its way again, but now it was August. The sun was warm, and I had another 3 weeks of vacation ahead of me. But at this moment, I was hoping there was a chance that, at the far end of this paddling excursion, I might encounter Mickey. Mickey. It was a dream anyway, and any presumption that the whole thing could be real was just fantasy. At first, the name seemed frivolous, given the exalted image I had of her. I had only seen her a few times. She had danced on the open-air stage of the Burggarten, the park that adjoined the Hofburg, the enormous palace where the Austrian emperors had resided in Vienna. It had been last May, 3 months ago, and they seemed long months and weeks. There had been an evening performance on the stage in the park. The air was full of spring, clear, comfortably enveloping, and cool enough to make anyone feel comfortable. Even in the dark suit, with a high collar, that was the rule when one attended an evening performance. The stage was lit brightly, and a small orchestra accompanied the dancers. It was a group of girls known as the Tanzgruppe Bodenwiese. They performed a dramatic dance with a serious theme, whose meaning I had soon forgotten once my eyes became fixed on one of the girls. She seemed to be the tallest, perhaps because of her blonde hair that lay smooth on her head, flowing back to end in some wide curls over the back of her neck. I had observed her movements, her tall, slender but curvaceous figure of incredibly pleasing proportions, ideally matched to her serious face. It seemed to express gentle, dutiful concern. Her hair, parted in the middle, gave her an air of a young Madonna. In one of the slow passages of the dance, her head turned slowly and revealed a profile of incredible perfection. A perfectly straight nose, a mouth with an almost imperceptibly retreating lower lip, and full, yet mildly concave cheeks. Over all of it, that glorious blonde hair with a definite touch of gold. There was no question that she was unreal. Nothing so beautiful could possibly live, walk, eat, act simply human. And I would never be able to talk to her, even just face up to a living thing of such perfection. I was 18. In a few years, I would be finished with my studies of engineering, leave that world of graciously desperate self-deceit in which I was living against my will, and go into some jungle in the Amazon River Delta to build the first bridge or power plant some thousands or so kilometers from the nearest human settlement. And then, someday, I would return to Vienna and think again of the Madonna profile I had left behind. Vienna, where music and the arts mattered more than the introduction of a new type of locomotive, or an airplane that could cross the ocean within a few hours, or one that would rise vertically, or ones like the DOX by Dornier, but twice as fast, with engines that did not have pistons but ran like turbines. I would never get involved in music or theater, but then, I would also never become involved with someone like Mickey, for she would never even notice me. Why would she, anyway? After all, I was too young. I had not accomplished anything. I did not earn a livelihood of my own. I had years of studying ahead of me. I had finished only the first year at the Technical University. It had been a hard year, and I wanted to spend the summer in a factory in a foreign country in order to gain experience in technology and learn another foreign language. I had spent the previous summer in a machine tool plant in England. This summer, I had hoped to be in France, to perfect my French and learn the terms of engineering in that language. But my father had opposed my plans. I should take a vacation, he insisted. He had made reservations at the Schloss Hotel in Felden. I was defiant. No posh resort for me. I wanted the smell of steel and oil, the atmosphere of industry. I wanted to experience the spirit of the workers, whose lives were spent in machine shops among belts that came down from countershafts of the machines, among gas furnaces that radiated warmth as they heated finely cut machine parts to drive carbon into the iron and make the steel harder, stronger. If my greatest dream came true, I might get into a place where aircraft engines were made, so I could be part of a team that created the power to fly. But my father had opposed any such plan for the summer. No, he felt I should come to Felden with the rest of my family, my mother and father and sister. And Mickey would be nearby, he added with a smile. I felt embarrassed, angry that he had noticed. I looked through the program after the performance, found her name, and asked my father some casual questions, trying not to betray my burning curiosity. He had answered just as casually, but he must have guessed something. Otherwise, why would he have brought her up just before our vacation? We were comfortably ensconced in a chateau that had been turned into a hotel. Spacious, solemn, antique in size, style, and layout, but modern in conveniences, surrounded by a wonderful old park. Shortly after we checked in, a friend and schoolmate, Peter Grunwald, had arrived from Vienna, along with his folding boat. We had been friends for many years, but our ways had diverged, and I had embarked on my studies in engineering. But we each had some passing interest in each other's field. His folding boat was of the sturdy two-seater type, with a strong wooden structure that could be assembled on the beach and covered with a rubber skin to make something like a two-man kayak. Day after day, we paddled on the lake, along the shore, on smooth water and in the wakes of motorboats. Sometimes, we climbed overboard for a swim, here in this place that denied the existence of a real world beyond the foothills and mountains behind the shore. That afternoon, I had suggested that we paddle straight on eastwards, towards the end of the lake, as far as we could go, to see more of the lake, of the shore, of the villages and hotels and... No, just of the villages and hotels. "We should turn around and go back," Peter said. I had expected this for some time. We had paddled well into mid-afternoon, and the way back was as long as the way we had gone. Longer, possibly, for we would be tired. He was right, of course, but he did not know my foolish plan. I was far too ashamed to say that I wanted to go on beyond the peninsula ahead, beyond the resort town of Portschach, to a small village on the lake shore. It had the somewhat awkward name of Kumpendorf, and it did not have the fashionable reputation of Portschach, and certainly not of Felden. But when my father had said that Mickey would be nearby, he had casually mentioned that she was going to stay in Kumpendorf. So I had this silly plan now to paddle on until I can see Kumpendorf, just to know that I had been there, at the place where she was, knowing that there was no time to go ashore and find out where she was staying. And even if there were time, could I go around in swim trunks, asking for the address of a visitor? And even if I found her, how could I approach her? She didn't know me. She wouldn't care to spend any time with me. It was a foolish quest, but I was going to paddle my way to Krumpendorf against the water, time, reason, and Peter Grunwald. "Let's just go beyond Portschach," I answered casually, paddling steadily, but with an increased effort, which I did my best to conceal. "You'll be late for dinner," he warned me, and he was right. I was to join my parents for dinner at the Schloss Hotel in Felden at 6. Peter stayed in a small private house, where he rented a room and was free to take his meals anywhere, at any time. The meals at our hotel were luxurious, and during the entire time of Peter's visit to Felden, I had a feeling of guilt, a little like the rich man's son with a poor friend. But at this moment, I envied him. He was right. I would be late for dinner, if we didn't return immediately and paddle full power on the way back. "Just beyond the peninsula to see what's there," I said casually, and kept paddling. I knew it was crazy because the peninsula extended quite a way into the lake, and it was a long stretch to travel at our slow pace. But I was intent on reaching Krumpendorf. Then I could tell myself that I had been where Miki was. I might meet her later in Vienna and find something to talk about by saying I had seen Krumpendorf, where she had been that summer. In the program of that dance performance at the Burggarten in Vienna, her name was listed as Miketa Hirmer. Perhaps this was a stage name, but my father had referred to her as Mickey or Miki, whatever the spelling might be. She probably was now on the terrace of the hotel in Portschach, dancing with some tall, handsome stranger, and perhaps, at some point, she might look out over the water and see a little folding boat passing by. "It's really getting late," Peter said, and sniffed. He always sniffed, after every sentence, except on rare occasions when he had happened to hit upon a subject that held his special interest, like anatomy, embryology, or socialism. On those occasions, he bunched several sentences into one, talking rapidly, and sniffed only once for each bunch of sentences. But I ignored him and tried to come up with a plan that made sense. The sensible thing would have been to go, on some other day, to the Kurat, the tourist information center in Krumpendorf, introduce myself and inquire about the address of Miss Miketa Hirma. I would be properly dressed when I showed up at her hotel, pension, or guest house and introduced myself. Then I could ask if she cared to join my family one evening for dinner at our hotel. I would try to keep it casual, not reveal that I was scared and embarrassed and deathly afraid of being close to a Didi with blonde hair and a Madonna profile, and a royally feminine figure and bright blue eyes. Of course, she would probably not accept an invitation from someone like me, but my father's name might persuade her to accept. There might be an evening when she had no other engagements. But I had not done the reasonable thing. Instead, I found myself in a little rubber folding boat, dressed in nothing but a pair of scanty bathing trunks, too late to paddle back to Felden for dinner, unsure of what to do next, and Peter behind me, sniffing. I started a wide turn to the right, paralleling the shoreline. The peninsula of Porchach jutted out into the lake to our right. To get around it, we would have to go towards the middle of the lake and then around the tip with a left turn. Peter took my turning as an indication that I had agreed to return to Felden, so he dipped his paddle into the water and took a powerful stroke, making us turn further to the right and almost into the sun. Since he was in the rear of the boat, he had more control over its direction. I had to counter with strong strokes of my paddle to pull the boat towards the left. "What are you doing?" he asked and sniffed. "It's going to be dark before long." "Let's just go to the peninsula and see the other side," I replied. Of course he was right. The sun was creeping toward the mountain peaks. We could hardly hope to paddle all the way back before dark. We would paddle back with the sun in our eyes, then in the twilight, and then in deep darkness. My father would be worried and angry, but I was still determined to go around that peninsula and get a glimpse of Krumpendorf. If only it had a more romantic name. At this point, Peter suggested that we leave the boat somewhere and take one of the passenger ships connecting the towns on the lakeshore, stopping at Porchach, Felden, and other places. We had made a wide turn to the left. The sun was clearly behind us now, and the air was cooler. Not far from us was a small sailboat, barely moving in the light breeze of the lake. One could see that the people in the boat were pulling out a pair of oars to row back to shore. Further out, a rowboat was slowly moving in a wide arc, making ripples in the otherwise smooth water. I could see that there were several people in the boat. One was sitting near the bow, facing the stern and pulling the oars in easy, graceful strokes. I compared his rowing with ours and concluded that our boat made far more speed, with less effort. A clumsy thing, such a wooden rowboat, in which one had to sit facing backwards to row forward. An unimportant thing, such a rowboat, but for some reason it held my attention. Then I saw a spot of gold in the rowboat. It couldn't be, but it was there. It was the gold of blonde hair, like the hair I had admired in the stage lights. I did not feel our boat moving as it flew lightly under the water towards the little rowboat ahead. Behind me, I heard something like Peter's voice, something like, "What are you doing?" or some other unimportant remark. I slowed down just as we were next to the rowboat and I looked straight into, yes, straight into that face I remembered. The blonde, the golden blonde hair, parted in the center, flowing back in a large, open curl. The blue, innocent eyes, questioning, with a light smile. The Madonna-like expression, the little straight nose, the curved lips, the light complexion with that faint, gradual shading of red at the cheeks. It was Mickey, just as I remembered her. But now she was before me, and I realized that I had to say something. A greeting, an explanation, something that would not be final, not casual. The gentleness of her face and her light smile of surprise were at least encouraging. I never remembered afterwards what I had said to her. I only knew that I was in a cloud, a daze, some strangely elated condition, as we turned our little boat and paddled towards the shore. I remember some remark from Peter, "So that's why," or "So that's what you had in mind," with the mandatory sniffing, and this time, some added giggling. I now knew her personally, had introduced myself, and she had smiled at me, and agreed to come to a dance at the hotel in Felden that evening. It was so much more than I could comprehend, but the sun had started to touch the rim of the mountains, and I had to be back in Felden. Not too late to be ready for dinner, dress, explain, and be ready for the evening that I had dreamed about. I realized that I was not up to it. She was too beautiful. She was older than me, probably, as old as 22. It was senseless, impossible, but it was a connection. We tied the boat to one of the poles on the landing pier and got on the passenger ship to Felden. For some reason, I had brought along a small amount of money, kept in a bag tied to the inside of the boat, so we were able to purchase tickets. The ride back was fast. Engines make things faster than paddles. I was a little shaky now, and even cold, because we were in our bathing suits, shivering in the light breeze as the ship moved rapidly through the evening air. I knew that I would live through this evening if I didn't spoil it by behaving awkwardly or saying something foolish. Wasn't it enough to have good fortune to have met her, unplanned, unprepared, on the Lake of Voot? The terrace of the hotel was at its best that night. The air was gentle and the sky was clear and studded with glittering stars as I danced with her. She was gracious and kind. She danced with the ease that I had expected after seeing her on stage. I was dazed and made insecure by the feeling of my arm around her waist, thin, supple, alive. I did not dare to move it slightly down to become aware of the start of the roundness of her hips, nor upwards where the elegant curvature of her chest would begin. I found myself thinking of calculus, the method by which one could calculate the narrowest point of a curve. I tried to convince myself that, for this brief moment in time, I was in heaven, not in school. Nor did I dare look directly at her face, although I did my best to catch glimpses of those open, wide eyes with the seriously gentle expression, eyes as blue as the sky earlier that day. Sometimes, when we turned a little out of synchronism, I thought that I breathed the light wave of the fragrance of her hair, that golden stream, tight around her head, parted perfectly in the middle, flowing backwards behind her shoulders. I felt awkward and shy and disturbed and hated myself for being only what I was, so poorly matched to this image of a Madonna in blonde and blue. She was friendly, gentle, and unaffected. I learned that the end of her vacation was near. She would only be here 3 more days. She had enjoyed her time in the sun, in the water, her days without cares and schedules. I tried to talk about her dancing, her performances, her plans, and she answered freely, but it soon became clear that she preferred not to talk about herself. I noticed that she did not wear any makeup or lipstick, and I was happy about it. Artificially enhanced beauty would have disturbed the image of perfection I was determined to see in her. I faintly realized that I was not thinking clearly. I only knew that my right arm held Mickey's slender waist, my left hand felt the gentle softness of her long fingers on my palm, and my face was close to hers. I told myself that I could not wish for anything else, except, perhaps, more of the same. I met her the following afternoon for a walk along the lake shore. We were not alone. Her sister and 2 other people were with her. I told myself that I should resent their presence, but my other self approved of it, for I felt small and insecure when alone with her. We took the passenger boat across the lake, and I became involved in a conversation with Mickey's sister, a girl some years older and without her serene beauty and charm. But courtesy required that I pay proper attention to her. After we landed, we went to the church that gave the lake its name. As we strolled through the entrance of the church and towards the aisle, I noticed Mickey kneeling before a side altar, devoutly looking up to the picture of the Madonna. Her slender, small hands were neatly folded in prayer. "She is not praying for me," was my first thought, and I felt guilty about it. Then, I noticed that her skirt had slipped above her knees, showing the fabric of her stockings tightly stretched over them, and slightly wrinkled near the back, making her look more like a real person, rather than the dream figure of my imagination. I realized that above those knees, the stockings would end. that there were soft feminine thighs above, and hips, and a warm, intimate area between them. A hot feeling of guilt and reproach came over me. I was ashamed to be entertaining such thoughts about her, the Madonna, the faultless one, the one so far above anything I could have ever dreamed and hoped for. I felt my face blushing and tried to think of other things. Mickey's last 3 days were over. I saw her off at the station, carried her suitcase into the compartment of the express train to Vienna, and placed it on the overhead luggage rack, kissed her hand properly, and asked for permission to call her in Vienna. She thanked me properly and granted my request. Unfortunately, she did not have a telephone, but I could send her a card or leave a message for her at the dance studio, which was located at the concert house, where my father was general manager. The train went off with proper steaming and hissing, but my thoughts about the eventual electrification of that line by harnessing the nearby river had to be postponed, because this specific train carried Mickey, and I had to adjust to the thought that I had met her and would probably, no, surely, see her again, and not just on the stage, in a month, when the summer was over, when real life would start again. It was 1931, and I was 18.
Thank you for listening to Chapter 1 from Dietrich W. Botstieber's autobiography, Not on the Mayflower. If you enjoyed, a link to the book can be found in the description.